In this part of the show, we have a healthcare topic for you. It's something that we try to do from time to time, at least a couple of times during the year. We'll be talking this morning about skin and skin care, and we generally do, at least try to do a show in the summer and the winter because the issues are a little bit different, but there are concerns one way or another. In fact, there are some things like sun exposure I guess we really should be talking about year-round. And here in Champaign-Urbana, we have three skin people that we sort of trade off with, and we bring him into the program occasionally. And we're very pleased this morning to have back with us again Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic. And if you have questions about skin, do give us a call. Whenever we have doctors here, one of the things I always say right at the beginning is, now, remember, we can't do diagnosis over the telephone, particularly with something like dermatology, because in many, many cases, to tell you what's going on, the doctor's going to have to see you. So do keep that in mind. However, at the same time, I don't want to discourage people from calling just by saying that, just to keep in mind that there are some limits on what it is we can do given the fact that we're here on the radio. But certainly, if you have questions about skin and skin issues, give us a call, and I know the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Great. Thanks for inviting me back.
I guess the thing to talk about is a winter skin issues to start with. A lot of people complain during the wintertime of skin that's dry and red and itchy and cracked and, you know, feels unpleasant. And I guess a lot of people would say, well, that must have to do with being exposed to the cold. And I guess really the big issue is not so much how cold it is, although that might have something to do with it. The big issue is humidity or lack of humidity. And it's dryness. The dryness of the air makes for the dryness of the skin.
That's exactly right. The lower humidity makes the outer layer simply more brittle and even a little bit more fragile. So it's less supple. So in the absence of the cold is what drives the humidity. Air gets dry. Obviously, inside you can do something about it. You can run a humidifier. And otherwise, you're just going to have to moisturize, and maybe even in the wintertime, switch to a milder soap that takes less of your natural oil right out of your skin.
Mm. Well, when you're making that decision about soap, is that something that's going to be very clear from the packaging? It's going to say, what is it going to say that you're going to be your sign that says, okay, yeah, this will be a little bit gentler than something else?
That's a great question. I suppose the deodorant soaps are much less likely to help you out in that situation. And that's what you want to use when it's the summertime, you're out in the yard, you're hot, you're sweaty, your skin makes a little bit more oil. So you might switch off deodorant soaps in particular. And some of them are just familiar brand names like Dove, and, you know, it's cleansing cream, it's moisturizing, Aveeno, some of the different brands that they will say they're gentle. They will say that they re-moisturize your skin. But you're right. There's really nothing that says, they'll say they're mild. How's that?
Okay. Well, I suppose that there are some that actually do say something about if you have dry skin, that this is a good thing too.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
What in addition to that? So I guess we're saying use a mild soap, and it's possible that in the wintertime you might think about, you know, if you can stand it, if normally you like to shower every day, you like to bathe every day, you might want to try and back off of that a little bit.
Right. Or even, I mean, so many of my patients bathe and shower twice a day because they wake up, they want to get clean, they go to work clean, then they work out, and then they shower again. Or they swim, perhaps, maybe for fitness, and then they have to rinse off or wash off the chlorine. So maybe I try to get them to go down to one a day, and certainly limiting the duration of your shower, because all that hot water, not only is it wasteful, but once again, it actually does dry out your skin somewhat, and you can diminish the heat and duration of your shower and limit the soap to the places that maybe you need them. You don't have to scrub your shins. You just don't make a lot of trouble, odor, oil, dirt on some of these other places that tend to get really dry.
Yeah. I tell you what, we have a caller here, so why don't we talk with them, and we can get on to some other areas as well. In fact, as I said, whatever's on people's minds, as long as it has to do with skin, I know that the doctor will Well, do his best.
Yeah.
Give you an answer.
My wise guy answer used to be, you know, I just hold it up to the phone. But the problem is with these new phones, I'm afraid someone's going to call me on it.
And, like, oh, yeah, Doc, here. Yeah, look at
this. Right. They're going to have to show some cell phone to me.
All right. Well, let's talk with a caller in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of questions. One, about treating a cold sore. Never have had one before, and I'm being told that's what I have by my husband, because apparently he's had one before. So I'm not sure. That I heard there's some stuff on the market, but I don't know what to really do with it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to throw out a guess here that your husband's not a physician, but he's an educated guy. And where are you in the course of this? What showed up?
Probably it showed up first. I thought actually I had a breakout, like a pimple or something on my lip, at the bottom of my lip.
Okay.
And it became kind of blistery.
Right.
And now it's kind of like forming a scab, but it doesn't hurt as much anymore. At the beginning, it was very, very painful, like somebody had actually given me a bruised lip.
Right. And did you, before it even showed up, did you have stinging, tingling, burning, some sort of sensation that something might be showing up?
Not really.
Okay.
No sort of
paper cut feeling or anything?
No, not that I can think of.
Okay. And the onset, when it turned blistery at first, was about how long ago?
Probably like on Monday.
Okay.
Yeah.
With this being Thursday. Well, you know, he might be right, of course. There's no way for me to be absolutely sure, but that certainly sounds like a typical course of an oral herpes simplex infection. That's the herpes simplex is the name of the virus that causes cold sores. And they can show up as a first recurrence just about any time in your life.
Okay.
What has happened, but we're going to presume that he's right, and I think he is, that when you were a child, you had an inside your throat, you know, sort of looks like, feels like strep throat, oral herpes simplex infection that you picked up in school or somebody sort of did respiratory spray stuff.
Okay.
And that then becomes inactive and gets quiet. So you had what your doctor back then said was, oh, probably the worst strep he's ever seen, she's ever seen, and you say, okay, fine. Well, then it goes away. You get better. Okay. Then under times of stress, weakened immune system, you know, too much work, maybe a sunburn from skiing, those sorts of issues, then that virus can reactivate and come out and infect your lip. You're then contagious at that time with the herpes simplex virus. So if you touch that and then put in your contact lenses, you have to be careful not to spread this stuff around.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So
my husband hasn't kissed me since.
Well, that's appropriate. And when he gets them, he's not to kiss you, too. That's the other problem. And, of course, you can get these other places. So if I'll see maybe a wrestler who's got one on his lip, and then some poor person who is wrestling against them gets little tiny herpes simplex blisters wherever that person's lip was exposed.
Oh, so it can get on anywhere, any part of the body?
That's one of the problems.
Oh,
yeah, that's.
Gosh.
And, you know, it got sort of famous a while ago as a genital area infection.
Oh.
It's the same virus that once you get it planted somewhere in your skin, it indeed can come back as it wishes in that same location. So another classic occupational hazard is healthcare people in the pre-glove area, in particular dental area workers, would be messing without gloves.
Mm.
And then they would get recurrent herpes simplex infections on their fingers.
Oh, boy.
And then, of course, then they can shed virus there. That hurts. Now, there are all sorts of wonderful ways to treat this. Now, you're a little bit past where you really need to do anything.
Okay.
If you get one again, there is a new oral antiviral. Well, it's not really all that new anymore. But you can actually abort the outbreak if you are starting to get the sensation, the swollen feeling, the tingling, the stinging, when the blister first shows up.
Uh-huh.
If you take 2 grams of a prescription drug called Valtrex,
and
two big pills, and then 12 hours later you take 2 more big pills, there it is. You don't have that week, 10 days of the open sore, the shedding virus, the outbreak where you have to be so careful and it's unsightly. So,
now, you have to have a prescription for this.
Yes, yeah. So you see your physician, you say, gee, I've gotten a cold sore. I'd like to have this on hand.
Okay.
The problem is, you know, if you're up camping in the boundary waters
yeah.
and you don't bring it with you, by the time you come back, you're broken out again. Of course,
yeah.
That's a great place to get them because, sure enough, you get all the sun exposure, all the physical stress.
Now, will I be getting them on a more frequent basis now that I've gotten one?
There's no way to predict that. Only time can tell. You know, the likelihood is you won't have one for another 10 years.
Oh.
So,
well, that would be good.
Yeah, that'd be good. But if you keep getting them, then that certainly is something you'd like to address. There are other topical medications you can use, but really it's true that the orals right now are the best.
Okay. Now, okay, great. So then the only thing I've been using is just like chapstick stuff. Is that pretty much okay then?
Yeah, that's okay. And you know, it'll help keep it moisturized. And at this point, it's going to heal no matter what.
Okay.
So I wouldn't push you to get anything to finish up this. There are a variety of non-prescription. No, there's, you know, you just go to the counter at the drugstore and they can find all those sorts of things for you.
Okay. Now, the second question I had was about, well, y'all had been talking about dry skin.
Yeah.
But if you have recurring dry skin or in a certain spot, someone said it could be a fungus.
Yeah.
So how can you tell the difference and whether you need to see a dermatologist for it or if you just need to keep putting, you know, lotion on it or
something? Right. Fungus gets a lot of sort of bad reputation because, you know, lots of dry skin eczema rashes are just by their nature round and oval. So people say, oh, look, it's a ringworm because they see a ring.
Uh-huh.
And frankly, this time of year, I think that you're going to see 97 dry skin rashes, patches of psoriasis, eczema, winter itch along that line, 97 of those for every 3 fungal infections. So if you're not, you know, around livestock or stray animals or, you know, haven't had chronic problems with fungus in the past, I would moisturize like wild.
Okay.
Before I ever blamed fungus infection.
So how long do you think, I guess
it's going to take a long, yeah, it's going to be all winter.
Yeah.
I've got some on my legs right now that I haven't bothered to treat just to see how I get along without much treatment. And you know, without putting on lotion and topical steroids, frankly, I'm not getting any better.
Oh, okay.
So I need about a week or 10 days in Florida and it'll all improve a lot.
Right. So basically just keep watching. But there's no other telltale sign that it could be other than a ring formation.
Actually, in true ringworm fungal infections, the majority of them will actually have a normal looking middle, and around the edge there will be a little bit of scale. So as it expands and grows outwards, the middle part of your skin, you know, of the spot will actually be pretty normal looking skin.
Oh, okay, so it'd be the outside.
Correct.
Okay, so then something like that, then that would require like a fungicide of some kind.
Right, exactly. And you know, there's no harm in using any of the non-prescription antifungal medications because they're not irritating. They come in a cream base, so you can put on a topical antifungal to reassure yourself and anybody else who's got the heebie-jeebies about your presence. And then cover with lotion on top of that, and you're wearing a belt and suspenders at that time.
Yeah, well, okay.
You'll get better.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, thanks for your help.
All right, thank you for the call. Bye-bye. Just two quick follow-ups here. Going back to the issue of cold sores, the herpes sore around the mouth.
Yes.
For somebody who heard your discussion of the antiviral medication that you can take to lessen the severity of the outbreak, that does not necessarily mean that you'll never have it again. Is that just for that particular outbreak?
That's exactly right. That's for that outbreak. Now, there are two ways to treat these. If people have intermittent herpes simplex infections, you know, one every year. If you go out and get a sunburn first thing in the spring, sure enough, you get a cold sore, or the middle of the winter, you get a cold, or whatever triggers it for you. And it's about once a year. And a lot of times these have a regular enough pattern that you can predict somewhat. Then it's worth taking the two pills to do the, to really dramatically shorten the duration. There are other people who I see who have lesions, they break out every 6 weeks, and they're making public presentations, or they're just normal people, and they say, well, I can't tolerate always having a cold sore. You can put people on suppressive antiviral therapy and do that for a year and multiple years to keep that from coming out. Now, when you stop those medications, sure enough, they will come out. So you're not affecting the natural history of the disease. You're just keeping it from showing up. And once again, it's fortunate because you're diminishing viral shedding, which means if you're caring for somebody with cancer who's immunosuppressed or other illnesses, or doing child care, taking care of your baby, and you want to play, you know, you want to kiss them and snuggle, and you've got a cold sore, well, you don't want to infect them, so you can do chronic suppressive stuff. These issues become even more important if you have the same virus in a genital location. Because, once again, some people will break out once a year, and then they can abstain or take whatever other precautions are necessary to avoid transmitting that infection. But you don't want to transmit that one because the ramifications are worse than walking around with a cold sore. Those people also go on immunosuppressive therapy. It's the same virus in whatever location, and we see it all sorts of different places in the body.
All right. We have some other callers here. Let's go to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Question about the pros and cons of glycerin soaps compared to other soaps.
That's a question I haven't been asked for a while. The glycerin soaps really are very nice moisturizing soaps. They've been around for quite a while, and glycerin is a very nice emollient, and you can actually just buy plain glycerin and put it on your hands. It's got a very nice soothing feel. It's a nice ingredient in soap, and it's sort of a classic ingredient in the Neutrogena soap, the original, you know, widely available glycerin soap. It tends to make the soaps dissolve quite readily, so if you leave them in a soap dish, you end up with kind of a mess and half your soap going down the drain. But it really is a very nice moisturizing ingredient for soaps and cleansers.
Okay. All right.
Second question I had was, regarding lipomas,
yes.
How would you identify those? And is there any cause? Is there any treatment?
It's a great question. First of all, how do you identify them? Well, lipomas are localized increases in fatty tissue and fibrous tissue also. So you'll have, all of us have subcutaneous fat, and you can insert your own, you know, American obesity joke here. But in certain locations, you'll just get this proliferation of otherwise benign subcutaneous fat with fibrous tissue. You just basically feel a lump underneath the skin. The problem is, I'm guessing you're alluding to a question. How in the world do you know what it is unless you do a biopsy? Because there are some things that grow underneath the skin, feel like little fatty tumors, and aren't. That's the other thing. That's the lay term for lipomas. So it often is helpful to remove, if you see somebody with 20 of them, you remove one or two and presume that the rest are the same. But really, the only treatment that we have available is surgical removal. You can either make an incision through the skin, and then they sort of pop out in this pleasant and rewarding way. They deliver through the incision pretty nicely. There are some people who actually will make a tiny nick and then use a liposuction cannula and then suck the little lipoma out through a little smaller incision. But the diagnosis is, you know, generally presumptive and clinical, but without a true biopsy, you're guessing. You're playing the statistics.
What would the statistics be?
Well, I've been doing this for 20 years now, and if you say something is a lipoma, it's generally a lipoma by and large. Once in a while, you'll see something funny. I've seen one plasmacytoma that sure looked like a lipoma, but it was actually growing rapidly, a subdermal mass. They've got a kind of a distinctive, soft, mushy feel, as you'd expect for fat. So if you've got a subdermal growth that's firm, hard, fixed instead of mushy around, you sort of get a funny feeling. You say, well, we'd better do a biopsy on this one. But frankly, you know, if you've got somebody who's got 10 years of 10 bumps on each forearm, family history of the same, and by the way, they often will run in families, but not necessarily, then you're more likely to be dealing with a benign lesion, even without a biopsy. Obviously, if you got questions, this is one where David was smart at the beginning. Consult your own physician.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Christie Clinic, and so we're talking about skin and skin care. And if you have questions, you can call us, and I know he will do his best to answer your question. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We apparently had a question from somebody who needed an answer but could not
They
call?
Yeah, they called before the show, so she left a memo with your reception desk. And she wanted to comment about hair removal product for facial hair for women with sensitive skin. And that's a good issue, because almost all depilatories, hair removal creams, liquids, are based on the same single chemical, which isn't particularly harsh and irritating, and it's able to dissolve hair. It breaks down the chemical bonds in hairs. You leave it on long enough, it softens them up, and you wipe them off or scrape them off with a popsicle stick tongue depressor. There are, however, a significant number of people who are truly allergic to that, so they put it on and they develop basically a low-grade poison ivy reaction. So you simply have to avoid all the cream depilatories. There's no other ingredient that will help you out. So for the lady who called in, you really can't use any of the hair removal devices. If you've tested your skin, a little patch by the side of your neck or a fold of your arm as the packages all instruct, then you break out with a rash there. You won't be able to find one brand different from the other.
Yeah, so you just won't be able to use that.
Won't be able to use that. You can have your hair waxed. Of course, that's a mechanical removal, which I've never had done, but apparently can be uncomfortable. There are laser removal devices for hairs, and there is a cream which is wonderfully non-irritating called Vanika. It's a prescription cream which doesn't remove or kill hairs, but it slows their growth very significantly. So if you're troubled by hair growth and you don't want to mess with it quite so often, it's a very nice product to sort of suppress hair growth. It's been on the market for about 3 years now.
Okay.
Good stuff.
We have someone listening in Maryland, I presume on the internet. Line number 3. Hello.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good.
I have two questions that I'm going to ask, and one is kind of a follow-up with the first caller and also with the last caller. With the first caller, I wanted to say that I had unfortunately acquired the genital herpes through oral sex, and I wanted to know if my partner would be able to take the Valtrex as a prophylactic, if that would actually help in preventing any outbreaks for my partner. And the second question is, can you tell me if shaving the genital area would actually irritate the skin and promote any kind of eruptions, what your recommendations would be on that? And I'll just hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thank you for the call.
So the first part of the question was, as I understand it, she has genital herpes and wants to make sure she doesn't transmit it to her partner.
I thought I heard it saying that that was the way that she had acquired the infection, and
right.
was okay. Well, I guess maybe that is the issue, that she's wanting to make sure that now her partner does not get it from her.
Right.
Okay. Well, I guess we can
now?
Discuss any. I guess. Yeah.
How she acquired it was a different issue.
Okay.
But I'm presuming, so she has genital herpes, so if she acquired it from someone else's genitalia or their mouth or whatever means, sure enough, now she has it, and there is the potential of transmitting this to her partner. The medication will not help to have her partner take it. But if she takes the medication on a prophylactic ongoing dose, there's data, in fact, some new data in last week's New England Journal that indicates that the infected partner can indeed diminish the rate of transmission to an uninfected partner by taking daily doses of antiviral. And in fact, there's a once-a-day dose now that's much more convenient. Used to be had to take two-a-day doses. So, and that's kind of a pain in the neck. It seems minor to take medicine twice a day, but if you can take a once-a-day dose, you can protect your partner by continuing to take it yourself in a suppressive dose. The other nice thing about the anti-herpes virus antivirals is they're really benign, safe medications. Not a lot of rashes, not a lot of upset stomach, not a lot of drug interactions. So you can really be on these medications for years and years and reassure yourself, reassure your sexual partners, and, you know, be a better citizen, if you will, by continuing to take these medications. So that's the first question. So yes, it wouldn't help for him to take them, though, necessarily.
Okay.
The other one is irritation from shaving in the genital area. And I don't know of any real data that indicate that shaving irritation and trauma would trigger genital herpes outbreaks, but certainly you can get irritation and secondary infection around hair follicles of shaving beards, necks, underarms, wherever you'd like to shave and groom. So there's been some evidence that if you use a little bit of betadine soap, which is one of the antibacterial soaps that are used in preparation for prior surgical procedures, you can use that and it sort of knocks down the bacterial numbers. And then if you gently shave or even clipper, you're much less likely to develop those little tiny irritated red shaving bumps that are part inflammation and probably a little bit low-grade infection.
Yeah, okay. So certainly the pesky thing about all of the various herpes infections is that the herpes gets into your body, and then it kind of goes and hides.
Exactly.
And occasionally you may have outbreaks, but in between, when you're not symptomatic, it's still there. And I guess one of the things I wonder about is if one very clearly is having an outbreak,
Yes. You
know that at that point, it is the person is shedding virus, and it's possible to pass that on.
Exactly.
But when there are no visible, when there's nothing visible going on,
exactly.
When you would say to the person, "So how you feeling? Everything doing okay?" They would say, "Hey, fine, no problem."
Right.
How do you know that there is nothing going on at that point? There was no virus present that's available for another person to come in contact.
Here's the bad news for those who are afraid of the unseen world. You don't. There really is such a thing as asymptomatic, no rash, no blister, no irritation, no symptom, asymptomatic viral shedding in herpes simplex. And it's low, but it's certainly there enough that you can indeed transmit the virus when you are completely, you feel fine and look fine and act fine. So this took a lot of statistical work and a lot of really pretty high-tech virology. But sure enough, there is some. That's why, really, if you've got unmatched partners where one has genital herpes, one doesn't, in order to prevent the uninfected one from picking up, we really do better by treating the infected partner long term. Right. So you really just don't know that is the answer. Now, there is a cream being studied, which actually is an immune-stimulating cream that has not yet the FDA approved, but they're actually studying it for perhaps even helping eradicate the herpes simplex virus. So there are some clever people who are trying to make that situation you described better.
Yeah. It is also the case, if there is any good news, though, that that eventually these infections seem to burn themselves out. So it is not the case that if you have it today, you will have to say to yourself that I will have this for the rest of my natural life. Apparently that's right. At least you can say that.
Right. But when you first get the message and the information, you feel pretty doomed. But yes, yeah. It's the cold sore person who says, "Oh yes, I used to have 5 outbreaks a year. I haven't had one for 3, but here I am today." Yeah. So that's not uncommon.
All right. Next caller is in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Why, I know venous stasis is probably classified as a cardiological disease, but it has dermatological manifestations. I wonder if you could discuss this condition and its possible prognoses and treatments.
Excellent. You're absolutely right. It's one of the things where the skin is a reflection of some of those other important organs in the body, including the heart. What happens with venous stasis is obviously sort of a sluggish blood flow where the blood doesn't return as quickly to the heart as possible. You end up with dilated blood vessels and lymphatics. And those patients often do develop rash that we call stasis dermatitis. And the real prime preventative, of course, is keeping the edema and swelling of the ankles and feet down as much as possible. And that's done by cardiac management, diuretics, elevation of the feet when you're up, but of course not giving up activity. You want to maintain as much activity as possible. But there also are some pressure hose that really can help. Some of the lower compression stockings actually can do a nice job without really being so constricting and compressing as some of the tougher ones are. once you get the rash, people start experimenting and putting on any variety of topical medications. Then you can get a secondary allergic contact dermatitis or irritant when people start doing, the home remedies of Clorox water and bleach and all those other, turpentine kind of home cures that sometimes get them in trouble. So moisturizing. The other thing that happens is maybe if some people have chronic fungal infections of their toenails and feet, that can play a role in making stasis dermatitis worse. So it can be a real difficult foot, skin, and general medical management problem. Do you have specific problems about this?
Well, I just wonder if cortisone or things like that help.
Yeah, the mild 1% hydrocortisone that you can buy without a prescription can be helpful. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, you need to see a physician who can get you maybe a little stronger topical steroid. They might want to check to make sure you don't truly have a little secondary fungus infection or even sometimes bacterial infections.
How about cortisone injections?
Well, cortisone injections are great for what's good with you, wrong with your skin, but they tend to make you retain fluid a little bit, and that's sort of the exact opposite of what you're trying to take care of in this situation.
So diuretics is a good...
That's a helpful thing, yes.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. On to Champagne, next caller, line one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My problem is the following. I am a 70-year-old woman, and for the last 15 years or so, I see that my hair is thinning in the back. I always had very fine hair, but now even my hair shafts are getting thinner. I've been using a minoxidil in the last year or so, but I really don't know whether it is has any positive effects. Can you tell me anything about treatment?
Wow. Okay. This is always a frustrating problem because the hair growth cycle is so slow, and that you're right that when you start using something, it's really hard to be sure if it's working or not. And what you describe happens exactly. And number one, if your hairs get both sparser as well as the hair shafts getting finer.
Right.
Because men's hair loss is generally a more dramatic problem. We study that more and understand it more and just sort of culturally sort of get our minds around that a little better. But it certainly happens to plenty of women also. We used to call that male pattern alopecia in a woman, but it's not really a male pattern. Most women will retain their frontal hairline and, as you describe, lose it sort of some in the front, but keep a frontal hairline and then bald in particular up on the vertex and the top of the scalp. The only thing we've ever proven right to work is the topical minoxidil in women. There's a pill men can take that simply doesn't work in postmenopausal women. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it works in premenopausal women because it causes birth defects and you simply are not to use it in premenopausal women.
Yeah.
So the best advice is, number one, stay with the minoxidil because even when they were doing the big statistical studies and clipping hair and counting hair numbers and taking photographs, it took a long time to gain FDA approval precisely for the reason that it takes a long time to show much in the way of an effect.
Uh-huh.
The other thing to do is make sure you don't have another problem, such as a thyroid problem or iron deficiency or maybe taking too much vitamin A, which some people do, that causes a little bit of trouble. Okay. Make sure you have enough protein in your diet. So those sort of general medical things,
yes,
also can contribute to your hair pattern. You want to make sure that that's not a problem.
I see. Okay. One thing I can say as a positive, I've been using Pro-Gain shampoo for the last year and a half, and I used to lose a lot more hair, after washing my hair,
right,
than I do with this shampoo.
Well, that's great. That's the Pro-Gain or Rogaine?
Pro-Gain.
Okay,
right. The shampoo is called,
yes,
Pro-Gain.
Yes, made by Upjohn.
Yeah. So that had, it helped for a little bit.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it. For people who have concerns about losing their hair, is there anything that you would say in terms of washing, how you wash it, how frequently, how you dry it, what kind of shampoo you use, any and all of those kinds of things that you could say either could worsen the problem or make the problem a little bit better?
First of all, wow, you know, hair loss is a great big topic, and there are a variety of reasons for it. You've got, you know, scalp inflammatory problems, infections, family history, of course, is a big situation. Most of our dogma says that styling, washing, all those things have no effect on your hair pattern, quite frankly, because the roots are down, you know, 4 millimeters deep into the scalp, and it doesn't know whether you're using Suave shampoo or Pert Plus, quite frankly. The other thing we do know about hair, for example, let's say eyebrows, and if you're an eyebrow plucker, after a while you don't have to pluck your eyebrows because you've run through so many hair growth cycles that they just figure that they're not going to grow. So you really can, by plucking and pulling too much, you indeed can lose some hair. So I worry about people who are rough on their hair. There's no data on this, but I think probably too much blow drying while you're brushing and pulling and yanking. If you're pulling hairs out by your roots, it causes problems. People who do tight, severe hair styles, you know, cornrows are sort of a classic example, develop something we call traction alopecia. And it actually, where you have pulled the hair out, those hairs, if you pull them out enough times, they simply tire and don't come back. But other than that, if it's just sort of a guy like, you know, me, 30, 40, 50, I'm at the top, whose hair seems to be thinner and finer, it's probably not from what you're doing to the shafts themselves.
We have a couple of questions here that came in actually to our website, and so I'll ask these. Someone wants to know at what age or if it's ever recommended that someone should have basically a head-to-toe exam for any and all skin growth issues. For a doctor actually to say, okay, take off all your clothes and look over everything.
That's a really variable question, and I don't think the dermatology community's got a date. Certainly, we see more skin cancers in older people. There's just no question about it. So, you know, 50s is the same time you have your first colonoscopy would be a great guideline to make up on the spot. There are people, of course, who have family histories of skin cancer, family histories of melanoma, for example, or if you have an abnormally large number of unusual moles, those people should be looked at when they're 13, when they're 15, and you should plot those along. So it really is variable. And if you're a very light-complected person and, you know, red-headed blonde and as such more prone to have skin cancer, you should come in early. And once you've had a skin cancer, then you really are committed to better routine of sun protection, you know, the usual sunblock, hats, protective clothing, stay out of the sun in the middle of the day, don't get burns. You know, a little bit of sunshine is probably not going to kill anybody, but believe me, you need to protect yourself if you've had one. Mm. That's not a great answer to the question, but certainly a baseline wouldn't be a bad idea at any time, and an assessment of your risk based on family history, pigment pattern, and prior sun exposure.
Mm. Well, I assume that if you periodically do have visits with a family physician, that one of the things they're going to do is kind of look you over.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I mean, different people have different senses of modesty, or they just want to show you one thing. And, you know, you have to respect people's privacy on one side, and on the other, you have to make sure you're doing a thorough job.
The other thing the caller wanted to know was whether a referral was needed for an appointment.
Oh, well, that's welcome to the world of American healthcare policy. In my office, we like to see everybody in the world. But the certain health maintenance organizations have referral only to dermatologists, but I think there isn't a dermatologist in the country who will see patients only by referral, unless they're at an academic center and they specialize in a very narrow field.
All right, have a couple callers here. Both of them, or we had our next caller is on the campus, line number 2. We'll go right there. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you could tell me if there's anything general you can say, if someone you know has recurring rash on the lower part of the legs, say around the shins, is I keep thinking that I hear so much about that problems with the legs are often cardiovascular. Is there anything like that in dermatology as well?
Yes, I think I understand your question. Is this a relative family member?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here, I'll speak from personal experience. I don't know, maybe it's sensible. As you get a little bit older, you just get a little bit of minor swelling in your ankles and your lower legs. You get the little dents that your socks form at the end of the day if you've been up on your feet a lot. And the other thing that happens is we don't have a lot of oil glands from the knee down. You know, your oil gland density, if you track it, is very high in the scalp and face. Those are the places that you wash the most. And other hair-bearing areas have pretty high oil gland density. And on your shins, you just don't have much in the way of innate moisture, if you will. So I see lots of sort of winter itch on starting on shins. And it probably is an overlap of both dryness and a little tiny bit of sluggish blood flow. And if it goes away with moisturizer and a medium-strength topical steroid cream, you can sort of brush it off. If it keeps on coming back and there's significant swelling, you know, if you can look at somebody's ankles and they're really quite swollen, you push a finger in them and it dents on in, then you say, well, this is somebody who needs to see their regular doctor, get a little bit of fluid off, maybe wear some pressure hose. Does that answer your question correctly? Or?
Yeah. Actually, she's got an appointment to see it pretty soon. So,
oh.
But I won't be in the room, so I thought I'd ask. Thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist at Christie Clinic. And if you have questions about skin, call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe we can nag people about sun. I guess we'd certainly talk about that in the summertime because we expect that people are going to be spending more time outside. There's going to be more skin exposed, but the same concerns apply in the wintertime, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's unfortunately not enough sun around here to really get a good burn this time of year, which is great. And also we're covered up when we go outside. Obviously, this time of year, the biggest enemy of people's skin and sun exposure is in the indoor tanning beds. You know, that's a hot button issue, but believe me, they can cause a lot of trouble. They cause a lot of photo aging. There's statistical evidence that despite what they might want to say, they do increase your risk of skin cancer. And you have to remember that many people in this community are able to go to Florida, some islands or someplace, and, you know, they need to not come back with sunburns and tans too.
All right, let's go to next caller, and that would be someone on cell phone here, line one. Hello.
Yes, had a allergic dermatitis for a while and been prescribed a flucytonide cream. What I'm wondering about is whether a antihistamine or that you might take for allergic rhinitis, that sort of thing, if
right.
That would be effective.
What part of your skin is the allergic dermatitis on, sir?
Face.
Okay. Is it fluocinonide, fluocinolone? Tough question.
Lydex is the...
okay, that's Lydex is the brand name. Okay, number one, that's a little strong to use in your face for very long. So I wouldn't want to have you use it on your face for more than a week at a time. Then that's even a little bit long. There are 7 different categories of strength of topical steroids, and Lydex ointment is class 2. Even the cream might be 2. It's either a 2 or 3. And that's a little too strong to use in your face for very long. So you might want to go off that and onto some of the non-prescription 1% hydrocortisone. If you do... the oral antihistamines, Benadryl, and there are a host of others, indeed can help with itching. They generally, if you have an allergic dermatitis, don't stop that particular process, but they help you with the itching and the symptoms of it. So that wouldn't be a bad idea as long as you can tolerate the sleepiness and some of the other side effect risks, glaucoma, some urinary tract things.
Okay. Yeah, I've tried the hydrocortisone in the past, and it basically just doesn't seem to cut it.
Right. It's pretty wimpy is the problem. But if you're having continuing problems with this on your face, do you know what the allergen is? Do you know what's causing this, sir?
No.
Okay. Yeah, so it might not, you know, then you need to have it probably investigated a little further. If you have a little acute problem where, sure enough, you get a little poison ivy on your face or you brush up against your pine tree that's in the house, you might tolerate a little bit of Lidex, but you do not want to use Lidex on a chronic basis on your face.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. To Champagne next, line two. Hello.
Hi. This might be sort of out of the scope of your field, but I heard briefly somewhere recently just a little bit about this, some new product that's been approved for injection under the skin. It's not
collagen.
It's something new, and I wondered if you, whatever it was I heard, it wasn't very much, and I was just curious about what it is or if you know anything about it.
Sure,
or.
Yes. I pay attention to some of these things. First of all, we've had collagen around for injections into wrinkles and to fill up scars and defects for quite a while. The first one out was derived from cows, and you could develop allergic reactions to that collagen. That's still in the market. And then there's another one. I have to confess, I don't know where it came from, but it's human collagen. So insert your favorite Soylent Green story here. And that's available for injection. Those are both approved by the FDA. The allergic reactions in the collagen, the new one, the Cosmoderm and Cosmoplast, are the human collagens. By the way, they might be grown in culture from fibroblast culture, so it might not be a creepy grizzly thing. I suspect that that's the case. The other two products are Restylane and, I forget the other, Hyalgan. And these are other products that are found naturally in human skin and other skin. And they're not the tough protein-y collagen. They're actually, and they're much more, they have much more duration in the skin. They don't have to be replaced every 6 months, nine months. And you can inject them a little bit deeper. So if you have a deep crease running from your nose down over to the side of your smile, the so-called nasolabial line or melolabial line, you can inject that deeply into there, and it will fill up that space. You can inject them into lips if you want to have the plump, full lips. And they were recently approved by the FDA.
Oh, okay. That was my next question.
Yeah,
so it has been...
Yeah. And they've been, some of them have been around in Europe, and now they're here. And some of the stuff is new here, and they don't have it in Europe.
That's what I'd heard about one of these newer things, FDA newer approved, was that it was being used elsewhere, and that people here were going offshore to have it done.
Or the injector was smuggling, if you will.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, and that's been happening with Botox and other injectables for of course, a long time.
So in as much as the FDA knows about something that's safe in terms of how long it's been tested and stuff, this apparently is.
This
but it's still relatively new.
Yeah, and it's been around. In fact, the one of them has got some little micronized beads, and there is actually a pretty significant rate with one of them of allergic reactions, and it's somewhere in the range of 16%. Yeah. So it's not one I'm going to jump on board on until, you know, another 10 years have passed, because you're really better off being, and it's one of the more permanent injectables, so you don't want to jump into that one.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Interesting. Bye.
I'll try real quick here to get one more. Melvin, Illinois, line four. Hello.
Yeah, I'm a farmer, and in the spring when I get busy planting, I was nerves or stress or what, but my hands just kind of get scaly.
Yeah.
And the skin, you know, I use urethrin every morning, but of course that gets washed off by the time you wash your hands a time or two.
Right.
And I didn't know whether it was the nerves or, because once the season's over and I get back to normal, why then it's gone.
Really? So is it scaly on the backs of the hands, tips
of
the fingers?
All my fingers, just not necessarily the backs of my hands, but on my fingers, just kind of like just scaly or just... the skin kind of just comes loose, I guess. And
well, I'm guessing that you're as a farmer around here that you've got cabs on your tractor to plant and all that, so it's not a sun or an exposure phenomenon.
No, and it's spring and fall.
Spring and fall
when
both.
When the real pressure gets on and there's lots of stress.
Well, okay, so it could be stress. There's no question that I see people with significant hand rashes that seem mysteriously severe, and then when some other stress is resolved, then the patients come back and tell me, oh, by the way, now that I've sold my third business and I'm only running two, I'm calmer and my hands are better. So that wouldn't surprise me from a stress standpoint. The other issues might be that you're handling a lot of different materials and you're probably washing your hands more. So every time you put on Eucerin seems like a lot, but every time you have to wash off the dust from the seed corn, the seed beans, because those are chemical treated, and every time you have to change the oil or transmission fluid or hydraulics, then, you know, you want to wash your hands there. So it might be that you're just getting it, you know, you're not only busy and stressed, but you're also putting a lot of wear and tear in those hands.
Okay, well, I'm just curious because, like I say, it comes every spring and usually in the fall, too.
Yeah.
And not necessarily that my hands are in the chemicals that much.
No.
I used to wear gloves, but I just wonder if it weren't more stress than anything else.
I always am more than willing to accept all that emotional stuff because it really does play out on the skin a lot. There's no question that stress will really wear you out.
Anything better than a Eucerin you put on my hands that will last a little longer if you do wash?
No, I mean, the Eucerin cream is really a nice, heavy, stays-on kind of cream. If you are washing, there is one, actually. It's a silicone-based cream. It's a little bit more expensive, but it's called TheraSeal. TheraSeal comes in a nice big dark blue tube, and
okay,
it's a silicone-based cream, and you can actually sort of feel it on your skin for through about three or five washings, depending on how harsh and vigorous you are, and it will, and you know, it doesn't trap bacteria or anything. It's actually a nice hand moisturizer for people who have to wash a lot.
Okay, I appreciate it.
All right, thank you very much. And we'll have to leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Lester Farner. He's a dermatologist from Christie Kling. Thank you very much.
Great, thanks. It was always fun, as always.